Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side two of For the Record program number 777, the OUNB file part one. This is being recorded on February 21st of the year 2014. In side two, we're going to dip back once again many years into the archives. We are going to excerpt now AFA program, formerly RFA program, number 15, The World Anti-Communist League, Part 2. This was recorded in March of 1986. In addition to my own voice, you will once again hear that of my very charming and capable co-host, former co-host Nip Tuck, who was of invaluable assistance with the on-air execution of this program and the other archive shows. In this program, we're going to hear about the death, the assassination of Stefan Bandera, the leader of the OUNB. He had jumped to Western intelligence after World War II, and again, the combat that had been undertaken by OUNB on behalf of the Third Reich extended into the early 50s. The same day that Stefan Bandera was assassinated, allegedly by the KGB, but in all probability by BND and or related elements, that day was October 15th, 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, defected, unquote, to the former Soviet Union. And as we will see, elements that were touting the KGB killed Stefan Bandera were also alleging that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of a KGB-trained assassination team that by implication then also killed President Kennedy. In the reading in the excerpt you're about to hear comes from Galen's Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, published in hardcover by Random House, and also from The Dallas Conspiracy, an unpublished manuscript authored, by Peter Dale Scott.
He also asserted that his real name was Bogdan Stashinsky. And that's a name that's going to come up several times. So Bogdan Stashinsky is the man, the claimed real name of this man who showed up at the West Berlin CID. And that he was a Ukrainian, born in 1931 in a village near Lvov. Since 1951, he had been an agent of the KGB, and in 1955, he had infiltrated the Ukrainian anti-communist OUN in West Berlin. After all this had been taken down by the policeman, Lehman Stashinsky made a startling deposition. He said that on October 10, 1957, he had killed Lev Rebet, one of the Ukrainian leaders in the entrance to the offices of the newspaper Ukrainsky Samostnik in Munich, by firing from a gas pistol a phial containing 5 cubic centimeters of hydrocyanic acid into Rebet's face. He then calmly added that 2 years later, October 15, 1959, he had murdered the leader of OUN, Stefan Bandera, in exactly the same manner. His KGB superiors had ordered him to return to Moscow from East Berlin, but he was afraid that he would have to carry out yet more of such assignments and had decided to give himself up. The German policemen who listened to this fantastic story believed not one word of it. They realized that the man was an East European, probably a Ukrainian, and that his papers in the name of Lehman were false. They knew of the sudden deaths of Rebet and Bandera in Munich, but in both cases investigations had resulted in a verdict of death by natural causes, though under strange circumstances. Rebet had been found lifeless in the entrance hall of his office in Munich's Karlsplatz, still clutching an attaché case. The doctors stated that he had died of heart failure. Bandera, the Ukrainian leader who had worked for the British SIS, then during the war for the Nazis, and afterwards again for the British Secret Service and CIA in Germany, was found dead in front of the door of his apartment in Zeppelinstrasse in Munich. In his case, protracted investigations were carried out, since it was accepted that he might have been murdered, but no injury of any kind was found, nor was poisoning established, and the pathologist pronounced death from natural causes, namely heart failure. Stashinsky demanded to be handed over to American intelligence, and the German police chiefs gladly obliged. Investigations were conducted for several weeks by American CIC and Special Investigation Branch officers who distrusted Stashinsky's incredible confession and suspected him of being a Soviet agent provocateur, or provoking agent. Eventually, he was handed over to the German police, and BFV officers began to check his descriptions of his movements in 1957 and 1959. They found them to be accurate. Stashinsky also produced various documents, including a diploma of the award of the Order of the Red Banner, which he said he had been given for the murder of Bandera. Entries in his handwriting were found in the register of the Hotel Stachus in Munich, where he had stayed before killing Lev Rebet, and he produced a broken key, the wrenched part of which was found still embedded in the lock of the door of Bandera's apartment. He gave the investigators a description of the murder weapons, which catapulted glass vials filled with cyanic acid. He told them how he had swallowed anti-poison capsules given him in Moscow in order to immunize the effect of the deadly vapor by which his victims were killed. Experts confirmed that hydrocyanic acid could cause immediate death if squirted at the victim's mouth and nostrils, and that after paralyzing the heart, it would leave no trace. The investigations were conducted with the greatest secrecy, and no announcement of Stashinsky's arrest and confessions was made. Early in October, however, a BFV official telephoned Felfa at Pulak, informing him of the amazing case and asking for his advice on some aspects of the prisoner's statements about KGB officials in Moscow who, Stashinsky said, had given him instructions and the murder weapons. Felfa immediately informed the Karlshorst KGB office of Stashinsky's arrest and the progress of the investigations in Munich and Bonn. The Russians began preparations for a propaganda counteroffensive. On October 13th, 2 days after the Federal Ministry of the Interior issued the first official announcement about the strange murders to which Stashinsky had confessed, the press officer of Prime Minister Grotewohl called a press conference in East Berlin, to which West Berlin journalists and correspondents of American, British, and other foreign newspapers were invited. Now, before I read this part, let me just mention, it's hard to keep an open mind in these things because Cookridge himself is a real admirer of Reinhard Gehlen, and he uses words like the Soviets began a propaganda blitz. Now, this is not to say that it might not have been just that, but the fact that basically throughout this book, the operations of Gehlen and his people, most of them ex-Nazis and completely unabashed ex-Nazis, are viewed through the through rose-colored glasses, and the KGB and the Soviet Union is viewed through the eyes of somebody who regards them as an implacable and dangerous enemy at all times. So, again, you have to bear that particular focus in mind. However, it does make the book even more useful because nobody can accuse Cookridge of being a knee-jerk liberal or a leftist pansy or anything like that.
Now, a couple of notes here, referring back to information carried in past archive shows. Now, we looked at a key Gehlen agent named Theodor Oberlander in our last Wackel show, and we also looked at his link-ups with Bunker Hunt. Now, Bunker Hunt of the John Birch Society, Bunker Hunt involved with the Kennedy assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. And one of the things that Bunker Hunt was involved with in turn was a group which he was going to name the American Volunteer Group, which, interestingly enough, was also the name of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in Japan, John Birch having been the intelligence advisor to Chennault at one point. And what Bunker Hunt was proposing, and we read some material from a book called Spooks by James Hogan, was setting up, basically, assassination squads in the United States. The aforementioned American Volunteer Group was to be the name, recruited from General Edwin Walker's John Birch Society cell in Dallas. Now, of course, we looked at Walker's links with Nazis both in this country and in Germany in our Radio Free America series number 11. Walker, a former nationalist Chinese military advisor, okay, going back to the China lobby, the MacArthur Group, and so forth, again from Aryan Nations. Now, the murder weapon, which was going to be used by the American Volunteer Groups, was described as a gas gun developed in Germany, which would leave the victims, its victims, having a look like they had apparently died of heart attacks, and it would squirt hydrocyanic acid at the victims. The murder weapon sounding very, very much like what this Bogdan Stashinsky says he used on Bandera, and which may have been used on Bandera. The question is, who used it? And, of course, remember the Gehlen, Oberlander, Wackel, ABN, Bunker Hunt link. Bunker Hunt connected with Oberlander in a group called the Committee for the Preservation of Christian Culture. The Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, CDCC.
Okay, continuing on with the press conference. At the conference, a former Galen agent, Stefan Lippholz, was produced. He was a German, he said, born in 1907 at Staraya Alexandrovska in Volhynia in Russia. In 1939, he had come to Germany, where he fought in Hitler's army, and, because of his knowledge of the Russian language, was eventually posted to Schellenberg's Militaramt and became a liaison officer to the Vlasov Army. The Vlasov Army was a white Russian army fighting on the side of the Germans, which itself later became involved in a series of spy scandals.
And Galen and Oberlin are key people with the Vlasov Army, also the NTS, as we're about to see. Walter Schellenberg was head of the Sicherheitsdienst Overseas Intelligence Branch, the Sicherheitsdienst being the SS Intelligence Service.
After the war, Lippholz lived for a time in East Germany, then went to West Berlin and eventually joined the Galen organization, where he was ordered to recruit Ukrainians and Bielorussians for training as parachutists to be infiltrated into the Soviet Union. Remember, Stefan Bandera and his group were Ukrainian. He told at length of his work for the Org and how he became the landlord of the Stephansklause Inn in Munich, one of Galen's many fronts, and the meeting place of the Org's agents and V-men. His superiors at Pulak were Roman Henlinger, formerly with Himmler's RSHA, and Yaroslav Sulima, a Ukrainian who was in charge of training the parachutists. Lippholz stated that Galen had watched Bandera's activities on behalf of the British Secret Intelligence Service with misgivings. In 1956, Bandera and two of his aides, Voskovich and Benzal, were training Ukrainian agents whom the British intended to infiltrate into the Soviet Union by the way of Austria. Galen, according to Lippholz, wanted to foil the British plans, for he regarded them as dangerous competition to his own activities for CIA. Lippholz was ordered to approach Bandera's two lieutenants and persuade them to relinquish their work for the SIS and join Galen's newly established BND. They were offered twice the pay they were receiving from the British. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be, quote, liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. I should just put in parenthetically, this is rather interesting. We were talking earlier about Nicaragua, and it appears that something very similar to this actually did happen among the Contras in Comandante Zero, or Aiden Pastora, as he's known, one of the people, an ex-Sandinista who was resisting the Sandinistas but refused to play the ball game the CIA's way, was almost killed by an explosion at a press conference himself that apparently was set off by his own people on behalf of the CIA, according to later later information. So this is not an unusual thing to happen among people who are supposedly fighting on the same side.
Now recall also when a Contra training manual put out by the CIA was brought to light, one of the factors that generated a lot of controversy was the fact that one of the tactics that the Contras, of course, bear in mind their connection with WACL and with all the groups we've been talking about, one of the tactics that the Contra training manual developed by CIA advised was to periodically single out dissident members and make martyrs of them for the cause. Now, one of the things that we're asking here in the course of this investigation is, did that in fact happen to Stefan Bandera, as this Lippholz defector claims?
Start that last paragraph again. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. The Pulak official then offered Lippholz 20,000 marks for killing Bandera. They had several meetings and a plan was prepared to poison him. He took his meals in the canteen at the office of 67 Zeppelinstrasse, and Lippholz was given poison to put into his soup or a drink. The Pulak official gave him a fake passport in the name of Karl Lipnitsky, and told him that immediately after completing the assignment he could go to Austria, where Galen's agents would look after him. Lippholz stated at the press conference that he had not been able to go through with the murder of Bandera, with whom his relations were friendly. Moreover, knowing of several killings amongst the members of rival factions, he was afraid that he might be discovered and become the victim of the vengeance of Bandera's supporters. Using the passport Dr. Weber had given him, he went to Austria and then to Italy. In Austria, he heard from some Ukrainians opposed to Bandera that, quote, the Galen people had hired another would-be assassin one Dmitry Miskiv. In October 1959, he heard of Bandera's sudden death and realized that he must have been murdered by a hired assassin. He traveled across Europe to Norway and eventually in 1961 decided to go to East Germany and ask for political asylum, although he had never been a communist. He had arrived in East Berlin a few weeks before the Stashinsky case was revealed in Bonn, and had regarded it as his duty to inform the East German authorities of what he knew of Galen's efforts to, quote, liquidate Bandera 2 years earlier. Stashinsky's confession that he was a Soviet agent, quote, was a tissue of lies contrived by the American CIA and Galen. He was a member of UPA and had been hired by Galen to dispose of the undesirable Ukrainian leader. There was not much factual evidence to support these enormous allegations, nor was any better evidence supplied by another ex-Galen agent, Otto Freitag, who had also defected and was exhibited at a second press conference. The publication of their stories was conveniently timed to exonerate the KGB chiefs from the two murders and at the same time to discredit Galen and the CIA. Okay, before I finish, I just want to mention one more thing. We'll just want to insert something real quickly. Again, now notice, now, as far as Cookridge is concerned, that all of this stuff has got to be phony. He uses terms like enormous allegations, not much factual evidence, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Bear in mind, though, that we're talking that in the case of Stashinsky, who claimed to have done it on behalf of the KGB, he just happened to be carrying around a broken key, which just happened to have the other half of that broken key still left in the lock some long period of time after the assassination, the so-called assassination had taken place, which nobody had happened to find in the lock. Nobody had bothered to go to the apartment. Nobody had tried to open the door, apparently, or anything. And this piece of concrete evidence just happened to be sitting there waiting all this time for somebody
almost,
to prove it.
Almost 2 years. Bandera assassinated in October of 59, and here we are in 1961, and the key is still in there.
That's right, and Stashinsky is still carrying the other half of it around with him, even though it's a key that would link him to a capital crime if he was arrested by the police.
And which, if the KGB got him, according to usual intelligence, or at least some intelligence procedures, they might want to get rid of him if that key would have been able to link him and through him them to the killing. That would have been a very good way, if he was really a KGB agent, to sign his own death warrant.
That's right. So Cookridge is not Cookridge is fairly incredulous about the testimony of Lippholz, but he does not seem to be sufficiently credulous. Is sufficiently incredulous about the testimony of Stashinsky.
Adding one detail, of course, we're not holding a brief here for the KGB or the Soviet Union or anything else. Because the Bandera murder figures very prominently in the Kennedy assassination, as we're about to see, we're examining the circumstances in detail and taking note of some of these, frankly, incredible-seeming discrepancies.
Okay, last paragraph here. Felfa probably had a hand in producing the two defectors. Certainly, he was busily supplying the communists with material in order to keep the anti-Galen propaganda campaign going. During those weeks, he exchanged frequent radio signals with Karlshorst, but by then he was under close surveillance. On October 27th, a KGB radio signal to Felfa was intercepted by Galen's monitoring service at Stocking. It read, quote, urgently require advice whether unmasking action against Galen should continue.
Okay, now remember, too, that as a result of this, Heinz Felfa, Galen's chief of counterintelligence, who was definitely KGB, was unmasked. Now, one thing to consider is whether, at least in part, the Bandera operation may have been a trap in order to do just that, to trap Heinz Felfa and unmask him as a KGB agent. By the way, he was eventually released from prison and just a couple of weeks ago published his memoirs. Now, keep in mind the Bandera death and some of the discrepancies we spoke about. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalists and ABN spokesmen to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly, to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Reading that last sentence again. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalists and ABN spokesmen to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Okay? Later spokesmen for the American right wing sought to link Stashinsky to Oswald, some even speculating that they had both been trained at the same special Department 13 school for assassins in Moscow. Curiously, None of these spokesmen observed that the date of Bandera's death, October 15th, 1959, was the date Oswald entered Russia. So that it certainly is an intriguing coincidence that the day, of course, recall in Radio Free America number 13, three Americans defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. All three of them repatriated in 1962. One of them was Lee Harvey Oswald, one of Marina's Russian handlers in Dallas, who we're going to look at a little later. When being interviewed by the Warren Commission about why Lee Harvey Oswald went to Russia, gave the cover story for one of the other three Americans who defected. Now, that's an interesting coincidence. Now, bear in mind here that there is an attempt by the American right wing to link Stashinsky to Oswald, and, of course, the Bandera assassination used to build up the importance of the OUN Bandera to the American authorities, and to indicate how concerned the Soviets were with him, and also to destroy the growing rapprochement between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy. But at least one of these pro-Ukrainian spokesmen, former Representative Charles Kirsten, who had succeeded Edison as a member of the World Anti-Communist Steering Committee alluded to earlier, began to develop the picture of a Soviet assassin conspiracy 2 weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. And quoting here from a letter which Kirsten wrote, 15 days before he was shot down, President Kennedy was warned that assassins were being trained in Russia to commit murders in the U.S. and England. This warning was voiced in a letter former Representative Charles Kirsten, Republican of Wisconsin, sent the late president and his brothers, Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Senator Edward Kennedy. The burden of Kirsten's letter was an effort to obtain administration help in focusing public attention on the assassination of Stefan Bandera, the Ukrainian underground leader by communist agents. In urging this, Kirsten wrote, unquote, "The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee has been contemplating a hearing of the killing in Munich of the Ukrainian underground leader Stefan Bandera by the former Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, whose German trial Kirsten attended as counsel for Mrs. Bandera," interestingly enough. It was a bizarre assassination illustrating the subversive operations of the Soviet police in the free world. Apparently, the State Department is trying to prevent the hearing. Before his defection, Stashinsky was being trained for high-level killings in England and the U.S., There are others in such training, according to his testimony. I have been informed indirectly that the State Department called for a delay of the hearings and may possibly desire their cancellation. Okay, so 2 weeks before Kennedy's assassination, a key wackle person, a key person with the Wackle Steering Committee, who also happened to be the counsel for Mrs. Bandera at Stashinsky's trial, is warning that assassins are being trained in Russia to come kill Americans in America. And, of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, we looked at the extensive attempt to portray Lee Harvey Oswald as a leftist and talk about his connections with the Soviet Union, his travels in the Soviet Union. And we've also looked at the fact that he was almost beyond a doubt a U.S. intelligence agent who was being set up as a patsy. Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. 3 or 4 days after the Kennedy assassination, a Munich right-wing newspaper linked to the ABN, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, was able to publish the hitherto unrevealed story that Oswald shot at General Walker, and added to it the story that Oswald and Ruby together had been released at the insistence of Robert Kennedy. Of course, that's nonsense, and we looked at the setting up of the Oswald shooting at General Walker in Guns of November number 2. We also looked at some more of that connection in Radio Free America number 11. Either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee, of course that's one of the groups that resulted in Wackle, continuing, either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee added to the picture that Oswald was part of a left-wing assassination plot. The press secretary was Salvador Diaz Verson, V-E-R-S-O-N, president of the Liga Anticomunista de Cuba and a former chief of Cuba's military and intelligence service under Prio Socarrás. He helped start an unfounded rumor in Miami that Oswald, while in Mexico City in September of 1963, quote, met the Cuban ambassador in a Mexico City restaurant and they drove off in the ambassador's car so they could talk privately, unquote. Other Cuban exiles in Miami, in touch with State Department security officers, were at this time spreading rumors about the pro-Castro connections of Jack Ruby, and of course, as we looked at in Guns of November, Oswald as well. And recall also that Carlos Marcello's lawyer became secretary of what was of the Latin American CAL branch, and also Maurice Brooks Gatlin, another key member of the steering committee, hooked up with Oswald at 544 Camp Street.
And of course, the real irony of this lobbying effort on behalf of these people on behalf of the Cubans, the anti-Castro Cubans, was that all of Oswald's and Ruby's contacts with Cubans were with anti-Castro Cubans, both of which were documented in our Guns of November. And as we shall see later on, the irony of the pro-Ukrainians, anti-communists, that Oswald was some kind of a Soviet dupe, was that all of Oswald's contacts in America with Russians were with white Russian anti-communists, as we will see later in this broadcast.
Okay, continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy. We shall come later to Oswald's apparent link while in New Orleans in 1963 to Americans who were in touch with the Latin American elements of the WACFL steering committee. Maurice Brooks Gatlin, part of a right-wing group at an address used by Oswald for his Fair Play for Cuba committee, unquote, attended a congress in 1958 of the Inter-American Confederation for the Defense of the Continent, CIADC, along with Salvador Diaz-Verson, Fritz Kramer, Ku Cheng Kang, he's a key Kuomintang developer of WACL here, and Nestor Prochyk, P-R-O-C-Y-K, the chairman of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. All of this suggests a continuity, albeit one that may be more symptomatic than explanatory, underlying the significance of Oswald's contacts with Spaz T. Rakin in June of 1962. Recall Spaz Rakin of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations.
Okay. We're just about to go off into the strange, bizarre, and disturbing world of Dallas's white Russian community and Lee Harvey and Marina Oswald's connections with those selfsame folks at the same time that Oswald was being denounced as having been a dupe of the communists and the KGB. And we will be following those tangled and complicated trails when we come back from a short break.
That, again, was from AFA program number 15 from March of 1986. The filigree there, the tangle of double and triple Asians is indeed very complex. However, the milieu as a whole not only tracks back to the far right, but the elements that were handling Lee and Marina Oswald. They were deeply anti-communist or white Russians and other former Soviet nationalities, including Ukrainians, and in all probability similar elements operating undercover in the former Soviet Union were handling Lee Harvey Oswald inside of the former Soviet Union. And again, the assassination of Stefan Bandera was linked with the alleged KGB and or Cuban training of Lee Harvey Oswald, and the attempt at painting Oswald red was a very effective element of cover-up in the assassination of President Kennedy. The far right used that very effectively, and that kept a lot of liberals who might have been inclined to tell the truth about Kennedy's death. They kept quiet because they were afraid that a Third World War might result if they spoke up. All of the archive shows, my entire life's work, is on the SpitfireList.com website for download for free, including the AFA shows you heard excerpted in this program, all of the For the Record shows, long article-length descriptions of the programs, works by a contributing editor, and a library of old anti-fascist books available for download for free. The website is SpitfireList.com. There is also a flash drive containing that and other material available at a link on the SpitfireList.com website. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 777. The OUNB file, Part 1, being recorded on February 21st of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.